Good morning, Your Honors. My name is James Walrath. May it please the Court. I appear here on behalf of Defendant Appellant Christopher Hicks. This appeal is based upon his conditional guilty plea following an evidentiary hearing in the District Court before a magistrate judge, subsequently reviewed by the District Court based on objections from Defendant Hicks. An evidentiary hearing on the circumstances surrounding a warrantless entry and subsequent search of the residence where Mr. Hicks and his longtime girlfriend for 6 years resided. The facts are basically lead to two major questions. Number one, did Mr. Hicks himself object to the entry or search by the officers? And if so, even if the government's argument that his girlfriend, Samela Smith, later on consented, did not Mr. Hicks's own objections render the subsequent search invalid under the Fourth Amendment?
Well, his objections, they didn't ask to search it. House, did they?
At the time of his objections, a protective sweep, or sometimes referred to as a search for weapons or other people on the residence that might endanger the safety of the agents or police officers, that had occurred. He had already been cuffed.
In connection with the arrest, though, right?
Yes. Well, I shouldn't be so quick to say in connection with the arrest because, Your Honor, it's clear from Officer from Detective Brown's testimony that they went there to look for a weapon. On the one hand, he said, in one point, he said to look for a firearm. On another, in another place, he said firearms. It's not clear what specific information he had, and that, of course, that's an issue I've made as part of the appeal. The fact that he himself and none of the other officers really had any specific information. At any rate, but to answer your question or attempt to answer it directly, at the time Detective Brown approached Defendant Hicks and heard him object, my point is that the objection was to the presence of the officers. And I don't believe there's any confusion at that line or point in the cross-examination of Detective Brown by me. He clearly says, in fact, his answer is couched in a way where he actually thought about it for a second and then affirmed that, yes, Mr. Hicks did object to the presence of the officers. That was right before the very next phase of the operation was to take place. So the district court characterized it as an object to his arrest. Well, it certainly wasn't an objection to his arrest about to take place because he had already been cuffed. He had already been taken, in that sense, into police custody. Well, I think the more realistic approach to this is that he was objecting to the police there because he had already seen them going into various rooms as part of the protective sweep or search, and he was objecting to the presence of the police there in that residence. In general, and I don't think there's any confusion on that in that respect. I should point out that the fact that he objected to the police presence was the way the magistrate characterized what happened, but on the other hand, is not the way the district judge characterized what happened. But I think the record itself makes it clear that he objected to the police presence. I've provided the court with authority, and especially in our reply brief, on the significance of what does that mean to object to the police presence. Is that sufficient to say, I'm objecting to any activity you are planning to take here? I think so that this is not a case where it needs to be any clearer for a putative defendant at that point to tell the police that they better get a warrant or that they better have some authority if they're going to continue their police presence. Christopher Hicks objected, and in essence, then, what we have as a result of that objection...
Just go back for a minute. Because I've looked at all these cases that you cite, we don't have a case that goes quite as far as what you're asking us to do.
In what respect, Your Honor?
In the context of Randolph, to say that because he was mad that they were there, basically. I mean, that's what the testimony was.
Well, no, it was more than he was upset. The testimony is he was upset.
Right.
The testimony is that he was vocal.
Right.
He was so vocal that the reasonable inference from the progression of the testimony is he was so vocal that they removed him.
Right.
And took him to the squad car.
What is it he was saying when he was...
He was objecting to the police presence. That's how Detective Brown characterized it. I think it's interesting to note, Your Honor, is that really I'm here not relying on any testimony from the defense witnesses. I'm relying on the testimony from the officers themselves who were there.
But we don't have his exact words, I take it.
Well, we have the officer's characterization of his words. Yes. I see that
I didn't see the exact... I just wondered if there was anything more specific.
I see that my 6 minutes are up already. I just quickly want to say that the proposition established in Georgia versus Randolph here, I think, was clearly violated. A warrantless search of a shared dwelling for evidence over the express refusal of consent by a physically present resident cannot be justified as reasonable to him on the basis of consent given to the police by another resident. Of course, there are many other issues I would like to cover, but I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Ms. Cohen?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Koenig, and I appear on behalf of the United States this morning. I think Mr. Walrath is correct that this appeal may well turn on the question of whether Mr. Hicks lodged an objection to a search while he was still physically present. That's really the only way that this case could fit within Randolph. Mm-hmm. The district judge made a distinction between objecting to police presence and objecting to a search specifically. And we are defending that distinction on appeal. I realize that Mr. Walrath thinks that's cutting things a little too fine, but I would say no finer than the distinctions in Randolph itself. For example, between the physically present objecting co-tenant and the person who's nearby but not invited to the colloquy. Mr. Walrath is also correct that the only credible testimony about what Mr. Hicks said before being removed came from Detective Brown, a 25-year veteran of the police force. On cross-examination, Mr. Walrath asked, did you have any kind of a conversation with Mr. Hicks about whether he would consent to search? And I'm sorry, I'm on page 32 of the suppression transcript. No, I did not. Mr. Hicks was very upset that we were there. I had him dressed and taken out to the car. When you say very upset, how did you know he was upset? Because he was vocal talking about why are we there. He was very upset. What else did he say besides why are you here? I really don't recall everything he said. Well, he objected to your searching, didn't he? I didn't search then, sir. He objected to your being present? Probably did. Yes, he did. So that's what we have. We have a defendant who's mad, as Judge Williams put it. I would submit that's a fairly common reaction to having the police show up in your residence to arrest you. And I would also suggest that it's not at all uncommon for...
Christmas Eve, too.
I'm sorry?
Christmas Eve, too.
Oh, right. I do feel sort of like the Grinch defending a police search that took place on Christmas Eve. But
let me ask you, in your brief, you cite to the Henderson case, which is currently pending before the court, and there the government conceded at oral argument that objecting to the presence of the police was the same as objecting to a search by the police. So is the government taking a different position here? Isn't that contradictory?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. My understanding of Henderson is that there was a much more emphatic statement from the defendant, which I can't quote verbatim in court, but it was basically, get the heck out of my house. It's a very, very definitive statement. And that was either found to be credible, you know, it was either based on credible testimony or an admission from the prosecutor. I forget which it was.
And then if we find that, if we agree with you that there's a distinction between Henderson and this situation, and then we get to Miss Smith's situation, it was Christmas Eve. She was crying. She was upset. She didn't sign the book to say she consented to the search. I mean, there are problems there, too, aren't there?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The evidence reflects that the colloquy with Ms. Smith took between 5 and 20 minutes, that she was a fairly well-educated person with a responsible job, that the only officer who was in the room with her at the time was Detective Brown. Officer Meade was nearby. I think he was in a hallway, and he could overhear what was happening.
But she was crying. Right, and the kids had all been awakened.
Right.
And he made numerous requests for consent in that 10 to 20-minute period, and she didn't give her the consent initially, did she?
I'm not sure if there were numerous requests for consent. There were several before she acquiesced. That's correct.
Yeah, so there was more than one, more than two, more than three, and she said no. And then didn't someone tell her, or didn't the officer tell her that they could be there 2 or 3 hours? On Christmas Eve, if she didn't consent, they'd have to, in order to wait for the warrant?
The way I think it was presented to her was more of an accommodation than anything else. The district court found that the officers had a genuine belief that they could get a warrant, and I think the way it was presented to Ms. Smith was, you know, it's Christmas Eve, we can do this the easy way, or we can wait around for a warrant.
I wanted to ask you about that genuine belief. The district court focused on the belief of Detective Brown that a warrant could be obtained, but his belief was based totally on what Detective Armin had told him, and at the hearing, the suppression hearing, there was no test of that probable cause. Wouldn't it have been more useful to find out what Armin had, what information he had?
Yes. There's no way around that fact, Your Honor. It does appear that the guy who knew the most about Mr. Hicks and his background was not part of the execution of the arrest warrant.
So in evaluating the circumstances, is it really important to know that Brown had a legitimate belief that the warrant could be obtained? He's just kind of an intermediary for Armin, isn't he?
Well, I wouldn't rest my whole case on it, because usually the subjective belief of the officers isn't relevant in this context anyway. But the totality of the circumstances, there are some factors that would suggest this was sort of at least a difficult situation for Ms. Smith, but there's other factors that suggest that it wasn't. I mean, there wasn't any browbeating, there wasn't any, you know, trickery or deception, and this is where I think the...
What time of day or night was this?
This was 9:30 in the morning, Your Honor. The final point that I'd like to make, just briefly, Georgia B. Randolph announces a rule. It also has sort of a corollary that you can't deliberately remove somebody to get around this consent problem. And I would suggest that that did not happen in this case. It was a somewhat chaotic situation. The officers had information that the defendant was involved with guns. And their priority was to effect the arrest warrant and remove him from that situation to calm things down. And again, because they believed they could get a warrant, there wasn't really a premium on getting consent from Ms. Smith. It wasn't like her consent was pivotal. And so I think all this argues against an inference that Mr. Hicks was removed specifically in order to, you know, obviate any objection from him. For all these reasons, unless there are further questions from the panel.
Well, so if her consent wasn't pivotal, they just kept asking the questions, just what, to save themselves the extra effort of having to get the warrant?
Well, to get back to your earlier question as well, Your Honor, I don't believe that all of that 5 to 20 minutes was taken up by questions about will you consent to a search. There were, I think the record will support that there were other things discussed, such as it is Christmas Eve, you know, what do we do with the kids, getting clothes for the defendant, those sorts of things. So it wasn't as if there was, you know, 20 minutes of hammering on, you know, will you consent to a search. So we would obviously ask that you affirm the conviction. Unless there's anything further, I'll rest on my brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wallace.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 3 minutes, Mr. Wallace.
Thank you. 3 points I'd like to make in rebuttal or reply. First of all, it is incorrect to characterize Judge Stantmuller's finding or characterization of in which he, as if he was weighing the question of whether an objection to police presence is the same thing to objecting to a search. He did not characterize it that way. Instead, he and even though that's the way the magistrate judge found the facts and that's what the record discloses, instead he only went so far as to say an objection to an arrest or removal is by a defendant is not the same thing as objecting to a search. So I think that the government has cut it a little close on that one in terms of characterizing what Judge Stantmuller was doing at the time he, or thinking at the time he entered his decision. Frankly, I think his characterization is just not consistent with the facts. So his ruling is vulnerable in that respect. Second thing is that I hope the court has a chance to look at the big picture here. The police went, by the way, with the express request by Detective Armin to Detective Brown that he get consent to search. So they did go there expecting to ask for consent. They didn't go there thinking they would go about the process of getting a search warrant. If they went there thinking they were going to consent, and the whole focus and object of the search was to look for firearms somehow related to defendant Hicks, wouldn't a reasonable officer direct their first inquiry to the defendant and say, okay, where are the weapons? Where are the guns? Just give us the guns and everything will calm down. We'll just let us know. But they avoided that. There's no dispute in the facts as far as that's concerned. Why did they avoid it? Because Mr. Hicks was objecting. Because he was vocal. Because he objected to the police presence. And so they decided, let's get him out of here, and we'll go and work on, pardon my defense orientation, but we'll go and we'll elicit consent, hopefully, from his girlfriend. The other important fact I would like the court to be aware of, it goes to the whole question of the other issue in Georgia versus Randolph, and that is the deliberate removal of a defendant or a suspect in order to avoid an objection. And on that point,
tell me what was the time gap between Randolph coming down and this actually occurring? And is there any evidence that the officers were aware of the Randolph decision?
Your Honor, I don't know when Randolph was decided. I'm sorry. My time is up. My closing thought is this. I believe it's at the transcript of the proceedings, the motion to suppress, page 44, where it is clear that Detective Brown directed the police to remove the defendant to the squad, but not for immediate transportation to a lockup. Instead, at transcript page 44, he notes that while he was still in the process of talking with Ms. Smith, he then communicated by radio to the officers in the squad, and at that point, he told them to go ahead and take him down. So we don't have a situation where the government can clearly say, well, he was only taken to the and removed to the squad car because they had already arrested him. It was time to get him down to the lockup. No, he was still around. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace, and thank you for accepting the appointment by the court and your excellent job you've done representing your client. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.